Good evening, and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Jack Lepiarz. Tonight, we have a lecture presented by the Boston University African American Studies Program titled The Black and White Dream Dancers of the New England Past and Their Message for the Coming Generation. Our speaker is author Spencer Jordan. We begin with an introduction by tonight's moderator, African American Studies Program Director John Thornton.
He was an AB at cum laude from Harvard University with a concentration in history. And he's now an economic development specialist and consultant, particularly interested in minority enterprises, but also in especially, I might say, sustainable development. This is not the topic of his talk, but it is one of his passions. And probably one of the more important things that we can do for humanity is sustainable development. So I stand humbled before him in that regard. And as a result of a 1989 global broadcast project, he funded this small multicultural initiative for sustainable development, which has actually now become an educational project of his, Education for a Sustainable World. And the 1420 teaching and learning programs are now slowly being included in their educational standards by many educators. So the idea, I guess, is to develop sort of educational projects which people can then plug in here and there, as well as other things. I wouldn't want him to talk about all the stuff he's doing outside of his family history project, but he could probably talk to you for three more times on that project as well. So Dream Dancers, Volume 1, the first of this series, is on America's multicultural history with references from his own remarkable multicultural family background. So, Spencer Jordan.
I'm really happy to be here today, and I thank John so much for taking an interest in my work and our conversations. We had so many points of mutuality in terms of our perspective on history and its breadth, especially of black history that stretches beyond continents and circles the world. And here I am at Boston University, which is an honor because only a block away from here, I just went and paid my spiritual respects to Dean Howard Thurman and Martin Luther King and how history was transferred from one man to another just one block away. And that history changed the entire country and the entire world. A Dean of Divinity of Boston University teaching Gandhian, nonviolent, passive resistance that had more force than the armies of Great Britain. And he asked that this new kind of force be brought to America, this kind of spiritual force, and in that we might be able to progress and get over our hatreds and get to our equality, even as he was trying to do and did do in terms of making India an independent country. Today, our topic is very similar. It is exactly similar. It's a story and a study of handoffs of dreams that people have, just like Howard Thurman had the dream of nonviolent passive resistance to change. He handed it off to Martin Luther King, who made it a national reality and with global ramifications that still go on. But this handoff has been going on here for 300 years. And just by chance, my study for the last decade or so has been in those handoffs. And it resulted in three volumes. And the first one is The Dream Dancers, New England Preservers of the Dream. And the dream being, we hold these rights to be self-evident. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their creator with certain unalienable rights, and among them being life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. That's what this country has been about ever since, people trying to achieve that dream and the obstacles that life places in front of dreams. So I began with, let's go back to the beginning. Where was the first handoff? Paul Cuffee, 1759 to 1817. So we were talking about a 1953 to 56 handoff. This was a handoff that began in 1759. Paul's father, name is Kofi, and Kofi came from, was a Coromante Ashanti, who was captured and brought to Providence, Rhode Island, and was sold into slavery and worked his way out of slavery, was able to buy his way out of slavery by 1753. All right, so from 1728 to 1753, he went from slave to the owner of a farm. He married a Wampanoag Indian woman who, and all of the people there, there were no real African-American women in, or they were very rare in New England. So when people came, slaves came, they generally had to, if they wanted to get married, they had to, that, those were the only people that were available to them, and good and worthy people, but they were the only ones that, their son is this Paul Cuffee. So you could see that the idea of hard work, paying off, you know, I'm in slavery, I'm going to get myself out of slavery. Now that I'm out of slavery, I'm going to start a family. Now that I've started a family, I'm going to prosper. I'm going to work hard. I'm going to be a farm. I know how to farm. I'm going to build one farm. I'm going to build two farms. He had two farms, Kofi did, by the time Paul Cuffee was coming along. He gave Paul Cuffee to some Quakers. There was a handoff. The handoff of the son of an African slave, half black, half Indian, who as a child is apprenticed as a cabin boy to Quaker sailors, maritime captains who sail the Atlantic and sail the world. And Kofi's only thing was, I give you my son to be the cabin boy. You must educate him, especially in mathematics. They taught him the arts of navigation, and by the time he was 18, this man here was a sea captain on his own. He was starting to capture his own ships. And he wound up owning three ships that sailed even to Europe and to Africa and to the Caribbean and up and down the coast. He basically, as a Quaker, had another idea. He added an idea of hard work and freedom to the thing of, well, the American Revolution happened, and my ships were running supplies, contraband supplies, to the American Army, to the Colonist Army. He was captured in New York by the British and thrown in jail on an island, but they got him out in a couple of days. And he resumed his so he was a part of the American Revolution. So in 1790, he and his family, who lived in Dartmouth, Massachusetts, petitioned the new government of the new state of Massachusetts in 1780. Said, "Hey, we fought in this war. That's why you have a state. We want to make sure that people of color, which at that point who could vote was only men, that we men of color are included in the right to vote. And we want you to make sure this happens in the Constitution." And it did. And the Supreme Court voted. So this man won the first right to vote that we're still that we are still trying to obtain in full measure in between 1780 and 1790. So there you see the cultural handoffs, and it's going from person to person. Now, the Supreme Court justice, of course, was an English gentleman, you know, and if he had not been willing to accept that, the handoff would not have happened. So you see how the handoffs are going. They're going to Supreme Court, who says, yes, people are doing, everybody's doing it. And that made New England special to me. So he lived, he was a mariner, and his ship sailed out of this harbor, which is New Bedford Harbor. But one thing about New Bedford was that it had a specialty, and this is the next handoff to New Bedford. New Bedford was a Quaker town, and the Quakers specialized from Nantucket Island and Martha's Vineyard Island, came to New Bedford mainland and established a town dedicated to whaling. They got almost a monopoly on whaling, although there was whaling out of Nantucket, there was whaling out of Martha's Vineyard. If you've been to Edgartown or you've gone over, you've seen the big fine houses and so, but no, the bulk of the wealth came to New Bedford. And you see those whaling ships there around 1838, and they're lined up there, and all those casks are whale oil casks. And the motto of New Bedford City was, "We light the world," which they did, because all the lamps and everything was lit by whale oil. And the things that lubricated was whale oil. And New Bedford became the richest city per capita in America. Now, how does that tie to Carl Cuffey and the Black Experience? New Bedford needed lots of brave people because whaling was a very dangerous business, and there was a high attrition. So the whaling ships, as they lost people, would pick up people wherever they were. So they picked up, you know, people of all different colors and everything off the coast of Africa, the Cape Verde Islands, Senegal. They picked them up in the Caribbean. They picked them up on the South American mainland. They picked them up in the South Sea Islands. So New Bedford became an quintessentially multicultural town. People were all over the town coming off of these voyages. They spoke different languages. And they had one thing. They all had freedom because the Quakers believed in freedom. If you could get to New Bedford, you were free. So New Bedford became the destination. How many of you have read Frederick Douglass's My Bondage and Freedom? Yeah. Remember what he said? Where did he plan to go as soon as he got free? He made a beeline for New Bedford. And that was known all over the South, that if you could get there, you were not only free, you would be protected by Quakers who could give you work with dignity, and you could start a new life. So New Bedford had a very aggressive black population. Aggressive meaning, you know, aggressive about gaining, you know, a secure future and making something out of themselves. And the whalemen, New Bedford melded with black people right away. And they thronged there. Frederick Douglass came. Lewis Temple came. He was a slave blacksmith in North Carolina. But knowing of New Bedford, he escaped. He came to New Bedford and took his slave trade and turned it into a free enterprise in New Bedford, hammering out ironworks for the ships. All different kinds of hooks and things that were needed that were iron. He said, "I can do that." And he did it. And he became very successful. He also got an idea, a dream. So he's a dream dancer. He says, he invented a toggle head harpoon which detached the head of the harpoon which had struck the whale, and instead of just a stick that they're holding onto with a short rope, he had immense coils of rope. The whale would sound down into the water, but instead of losing the whale the way they generally did, they just let the rope run out, and the whale would go down and get tired and so forth and so on, and they would follow it. The take tripled. The ships filled up their holes faster. They didn't lose as many whales. They could turn around, come back, and make a profit. And New Bedford grew so wealthy, it was just incredible. Because that was the oil. This is like Rockefeller. You know, there was no oil. There was no petroleum oil in those days. Whale oil was it. This man made New Bedford rich. That's why his statue is in New Bedford. They admit, this is the man that made us the richest city in America. This is wealth that black people who had a dream very much helped to contribute. They didn't do it all by themselves, obviously. There were the Quakers and all the other people, you know, from around the world who did it. But they were central in creating that wealth with the toggle head harpoon, okay? So that was the spirit of the town. So many people like Frederick Douglass came there that who were escaped abolitionists. escaped slaves who became abolitionists. Here's one you don't know about. In the Dream Dancers, I always like to focus on people that are unknown. We all know Frederick Douglass's story. You know, we all know Booker T. Washington and W.B. Du Bois. These are people who had the same dreams, who put in the same energy, and, you know, just they did their niche. So you see, this tradition has been going on, and New Bedford was a simple, symbolic place where it happened, you know, where you could see it. You go nothing to the richest city, you could see, and everybody had to say, you did it, you did it, you did it, because it was a small town. Everybody knew who had contributed. So this was another guy. He's an escaped slave from Virginia, right? And he comes, everybody in his family is an abolitionist. They live in Washington, D.C. So Leonard Grimes was captured as a young man in 1838. He was bringing some slaves out of Virginia into Washington, D.C., where Lucinda Bush and her husband had a hackney service. And they would take the hackney and go down into Virginia as if they were on business or carrying somebody, and they would stuff slaves into the bottom or dress them up like, you know, as if they were free people and whisk them off. He got caught. He was sent to jail. He happens to be an ancestor of mine. And when he got out, he made a beeline where? Guess where he wanted to go to be free? New Bedford. He winds up in New Bedford, and then from there he goes to where? Boston. Any of you know 12th Street Baptist Church? He founded it. So he goes, he has a dream. You know, he's going to go, he's going to become free, he'd become free, he's going to free other slaves, and then, even after he's punished for that, he's going to really spread this message to everyone. So he founded the 12th Street Baptist, which is known, as you know, as the Fugitives Church. It became an underground railway station, a major thing. He just said, one man. I mean, he had nothing. He had nothing more than anybody in this room had. But he had a dream. And he said, I'm going to follow that dream. And he made 12th Street Baptist Church what it was. Lucinda Bush, oh my gosh, Lucinda Bush, what can I say? Don't say that the women didn't play an equal role in this. The women played an equal role. Lucinda Bush was married to an abolitionist in Washington, D.C. She was a freed slave. He was born free in 1800, but he fell in love with her. She was a slave. He bought her freedom, and they said, get into the abolitionist business with me. She said, oh, right on, let's go. And right away, they were in it. And she said, oh, I got plenty. I got brothers and sisters, and they'll all help out. And the whole family were abolitionists, and they were going, and they were... And so so when Leonard said, look, I'm out of here, you know, because I can't, they know me here in Washington, I'm going to New Bedford. She stayed, and in 1848, their hackney service, which also provided stones and everything, they carried materials, they brought the stones to the Capitol building to fit into the Capitol. Blacks actually helped build the Capitol building, and Lucinda Bush was one of them, she and her husband, William Bush. So there they are building the Capitol at one time and during the day, and at the night, they're bringing slaves out and making that dream of America real. So they're building the physical structure, but they're also building the people moral structure at the same time. And the people who are operating the physical structure are putting them in jail for wanting to build the moral structure. So it's a very interesting thing that's going on there in Washington. So they planned the largest slave escape in history, in American history. 73 slaves in one swoop from Washington. And they get a captain, a white captain. See, it's all interracial in this thing, as much as we like. You can't do one every half. You can't do it alone. Nobody can do it alone. They can't do it alone. We can't do it alone. Nobody. So let's get rid of those distinctions. So he comes in and he says, I'll do that. He has a sloop part. And Lucinda and her crowd and her husband and all their folks, they got Dolly Madison slaves. They got some slaves of President Polk. They got slaves of senators and congressmen. And they, 73. And on Sunday, they said, we're going to prayer meeting, which was allowed in Washington, D.C. That was the one time the slaves could be off and they could congregate down just south of the Capitol. And they just kept walking, you know, past the Capitol, singing and getting it. But there was a celebration going on of freedom, by the way, but white freedom, of French freedom. And so there's a lot of hoopla. So they would just sing and keep on going. They're just part of the larger celebration. But no, they're on their way to their freedom. I mean, history, how exciting can it get? I mean, how wonderful can it get? And so they just went on their freedom business all the way down to the boat and got on it. A storm came up. They were captured. They were sold back into slavery in Washington, D.C., in prison. And William Ward Beecher, the great Congregationalist abolitionist, white abolitionist preacher in Brooklyn, heard about it. And he raised money to buy them. Don't send them back. They try, you know, they're very brave. They try. And to free, they were sending the people, including Lucinda Bush and all those, to jail. You know, it was a crime to try to free people. So they're all facing jail time. Where do they go? New Bedford. They get the heck out of Washington and go to New Bedford. But the slaves are still in the jail. So who raised the money? You ever hear of Harriet Beecher Stowe, Uncle Tom's Cabin? When Henry Ward Beecher took his daughter, Harriet Beecher Stowe, down to see these slaves that he was raising money for in Brooklyn, it broke her heart because there were two sisters. There you see them there, the girls in the bonnet. They had been house slaves in Washington. They had never done field work. They had never done anything. They were, you know, and they were 14 and 16, and they were being auctioned off to a brothel in New Orleans. They said, oh, boy, man, we'll get so much money for these girls here. They saved them, right? They raise enough money. But that fact that these black people, and it was mainly blacks who organized this estate, could pull that off in the nation's capital just completely maddened and scared the heck out of all of Congress. And they passed it was a major reason for passing the 1850 Fugitive Slave Law, which then allowed, you know, and also the Kansas-Nebraska Act, which allowed slaves to go and be settled in Kansas and Nebraska. Okay? So that then led to the Civil War. So this had a major input into the Civil War. Yeah.
You said they were caught because of a storm. Is that because they couldn't get out of the harbor?
Yeah, out of the Chesapeake Bay. Yeah, the Potomac led to the Chesapeake Bay, and they were harbored right down at 7th Street Pier, you know, right by Jefferson, where the Jefferson Memorial is now. And they sailed down. When they got to the storm was pushing this way, they got to the Chesapeake, it kept pushing, it was a sailing ship.
Right.
They kept pushing it back.
Dependent on the wind being the right.
Exactly. The fate, which looked like it was going to turn into a tragedy. Here's another reason to keep the faith. The wind that looked like it would become a great tragedy of sending these people back and selling them out of a at least, you know, not physically harsh slavery into the deep south to the most brutally slavery possible. That wind pushed them into history because they were captured, because the whole nation of the Massachusetts, Sumner, all these people, you know, took up the cause. John Brown, all those people took up the cause and said, and they raised all the money and saved them. So instead of going into the fields of Louisiana and Georgia, they went into history. And they became abolitionists, of course. There she is representing an abolitionist in an abolitionist meeting. The guy there, freed, the guy with the central figure there, with the what? His name is Jarrett Smith. He was one of the richest, very rich New York white man, who spent a great deal of his fortune in giving money to black abolitionist causes. And he gave a lot of money to free those slaves, including them, but he also was a guy who financed John Brown, and he financed Harper's Ferry and the raid on Harper's Ferry. He was a bad dude. And there he is, and you can see Frederick Douglass down there on the side. This was a very powerful group of abolitionists. So that again shows you, if you hold on to your dream, that's how I call that book, The Dream Dances. You got to have a dream, you know. There's that song in South Pacific. It just popped into my mind, you know, that you got to have a dream. And you got to have a dream, really. You really do. And look what happens. You never know. And so I like that idea of the wind, you know, and the wind is pushing you here, and it pushed them right into history. And so the war comes, and it gets handoff again. Here's another thing. So these abolitionists who are living in New Bedford, here's Robert Gould Shaw. He's one of the wealthiest Boston, one of the wealthiest Americans. And the Shaws are like the Cabots and the Lodges. You've heard of all those rich people. The Shaws were too. They were all intermarried, by the way. And he goes off to the war, and they are all abolitionists. But he's a son. He's not into his parents are rabid. He says, I just want to be a soldier. So they and Governor Andrews, his parents, say, we're going to raise a black regiment. They've been abolitionists for 20 years. Now their dream has come true. We are going to raise a black regiment. And Shaw, old man Shaw, says, and I want my son to lead it. You know, he did well at the Battle of Antietam, and he was raised from lieutenant to captain because of his gallantry and that savage. That was more people were killed on that day than any other day in any kind of war up to that point. And so he takes it on. He's killed. He takes his troops and trains his 54th Massachusetts. You all saw Glory, so it's the movie of Glory. You know the story. And he leads his troops to in the Battle of Fort Wagner in South Carolina, and he's killed. And he knew he wasn't coming back. I mean, they told him. General Strong told him, you know, this is in essence, you know, your chances. You don't want to do this. That's what he really said. You know, you don't want this mission. He said, that's just why I want the mission. And so. There's some quotes in the book. There are many quotes. Clara Barton, who founded the Red Cross. The battle was so fierce, and there were so many dead and slaughtered people laying on the beaches of this island where the fort was. The fort guarded Charleston. That's why it was a big fort. And it was so fierce. It was just terrible. And one guy took 7 bullets. I'll go forward. Him. He's from New Bedford. He's an escaped slave. Sergeant William Kearney, the first African-American to receive the Congressional Medal of Honor, received it at that battle, fighting in the 54th Massachusetts Regiment under Colonel Robert Gould Shaw. Robert Gould Shaw died there. And if the custom was, I'll go back. The custom was that officers, when they're found on the field of battle, get returned to the opposing side to be buried. It was one of the things that officers got. When he was killed in front of Fort Wagner, the Southerners got a great big ditch and threw all the bodies in there and threw his body in there with it and covered it up. And when the Shaws, this rich patrician family up here in Boston, says, you know, we're expecting the body of our son to be returned, and the Southern general said, oh, him, we threw him in the ditch with his niggers. And that was what was written to them. And they wrote him back. They said, that was very interesting. That was what we had in mind for him. He could have no finer honor. That's pretty classy. So here you have this man, Governor Andrews of Massachusetts. We're talking about New England. And remember, all this is happening right here in New England. And Governor Andrews told the 54th Massachusetts, he said, we've been in the Revolutionary War, the War of 1812, many different things. Our Massachusetts flag, the Indian War, our Massachusetts flag has never been taken from us, and it has never, you know, tasted the ground. And he took it seriously. The flag bearer was shot, and he was standing next to the flag bearer as they were assaulting the wall there. And he saw the flag, you know, dropping. He jumped over and grabbed the flag and kept on going up the wall. When he got to the wall, now there are four times as many Southerners on the other side of that wall as there are these black attacking troops. Yet they kept going. And they told, you're outnumbered 4-1. They were wanted glory. They wanted respect for their race. And they, one out of every four, never left that beach. And there they are on top of the wall. He grabs it, and he gets hit seven times, seven bullets. And they're pushed off of the wall, and he goes back, all the way back across the beach, stumbling over all these bodies, and he turns it in to the superior commander. And he won't turn it over to anybody else, and he's losing blood all the time. And they finally find the superior commander, you know, because the real commander is dead, you know. So he turns it, and he hands it in, and he salutes. He says, "This flag, sir, she never touched the ground." And then he passed out. I mean, you know, you got to have a dream. You got to have a dream. So this man grew up in New Bedford. The Civil War is now over. We're getting to the 20th century. All of that glory that you saw in the movie Glory and all of the glory that you just heard said there has gone by. Where the South has returned and is oppressing black people again, and the North has lost its interest. You know, it's lost its energy to keep on. It's just been too much war, too much blood. To the abolitionists, they're tired. They're tired of Negroes, you know. They're tired of all this thing. And all they want to do now is go west, conquer the west, and make a heck of a lot of money. Wall Street is booming. You know, there's this whole bourgeois society that's booming. And Negroes are basically abandoned. Black people, whatever you want, you know, colored people. There's so many names. They all mean the same thing. Are abandoned. And that's when segregation sweeps down, the Ku Klux Klan and everything else. Another generation of people like him, Edwin B. Jourdain Jr., who, by the way, was the predecessor of bringing a dream to Boston University, not near as great a worldwide impact as those two giants over there in Marsh Chapel. I mean, whoa. But he had this, he knew William Kearney. They all were in this small town, New Bedford. They worshipped Kearney. They worshipped everybody who was in the 54th. His uncle was in the 54th. His aunt was in the 54th as a nurse. She went wherever the 54th went. And so, you know, he grows up with all these legends. So he's saying he was a great artist, and he was going to be an artist and go to Swain Art School. But he says, I want to have a career that can help propel our people out of this morass that these people have left and abandoned us into. So he went to law school right here at BU, graduated in 1888. While he was here, up there on Beacon Hill, is another, these three women. They weren't all on Beacon Hill. Josephine St. Pierre Ruffin was. She started sewing battle flags and clothes for the Union Army here in Boston. She was born in Boston. Her father was from Martinique. He spoke French. And he was a very dapper guy who somehow wangled his way into a very prosperous clothing store. Something about, you know, he's French. He had that French air. And so he had a high clientele. And so she was, you know, went to all kinds of good schools and everything. But she became a rabid, you know, black activist when she was like 15 years old. And so she worked for the Union Army, you know, the civilian front, the home front. And there she meets a person who you ever hear that song, The Battle Hymn of the Republic, Mine Eyes Have Seen the Glory of the... You know the name of the woman who wrote that was Julia Ward Howe. Julia Ward Howe is at the next table. She's a young girl. who's passionately believed. They have the same dream, black woman, white woman. They're both sewing, you know, stuff for the same soldiers out there who are trying to keep that dream alive. And they become very good friends, lifelong friends. And she does so many things. She formed schools in Atlanta for, you know, the children in the poor section for the sons and daughters of the freed slaves. She forms a school in Liberia. Remember Paul Cuffey way back at the beginning? You know, he's got those people. Oh, by the way, did I tell you he was the first to take slaves back, freed Africans back to form the nation of Liberia on his own ships. Black people seeing the plight of black people and seeing, more importantly, the potential. They said, these people all once grew food and products very successfully for white people. We can do it for ourselves. Let's go back to Africa, bring your new form of agriculture that you've learned here. And they did, and they formed plantations, and they were financed by Quakers, because white Quakers, because he was a devout Quaker. So now she hears about that. They all know about Cuffey because why? He lives in Massachusetts. Everybody knew about Paul Cuffey, and they know that there's this place called Liberia and Sierra Leone that are free, they're the only free places in Africa. Because of what? A black New Englander, Paul Cuffey. So she gets the women together and forms a school there. So she's got a school in Liberia. She goes to Liberia. She doesn't, you know, and spends time with them. And she's well dressed. She could have had the easiest life you ever wanted to imagine. She had a home on Beacon Hill. She didn't spend much time there. she was out fulfilling a dream. The American dream. The American dream. And so did Ida B. Wells. Opposite, completely opposite background. Born in Holly Springs, Mississippi. I was down there during the Civil Rights Movement. Ida B. Wells, became an anti-lynching advocate. And she would face down, go into the most dangerous places and face down and stop lynching and advocate against lynching and write up lynchings and bring them out and, you know, demand that they go to be pulled to justice. She was always, you know, being threatened and everything. And the other person was Mary Church Terrell, and who, you know, the same thing, you know, giving her life for advancing the cause of black people. All these women got together and formed the Afro-American Federation of Afro-American Women. That was the first federation that then became the National Association of Colored Women. And that eventually is now, you know, the National Council of Negro Women. Okay? Now, they started this. All right? She has that home, and that's where this guy goes. She invites this young man and all college students around BU and Harvard and Northeast and everything who, look, you got nowhere to go. You're homeless here. Come to my house on Sunday. You know, we'll have repast for you. You talk about your studies, you know. So they all got to know each other. So, and you know who was a part of that? The youngest one, W.B. Du Bois, who arrives at Harvard. So they all know each other. So So they come down the hill right near where we are on Sundays, and they would go to the Boston Commons, where these statues now, you see how connected, there was a real Robert Gulshaw, there was a real 54th, they're all dead now, you know, not, or they're old, and many of them are dead, but they live on because Boston wants to build a statue to them. So this other generation is coming down to discuss, when will the statue be ready? When will the statue? It's going to be here. It's going to be there. And it would trigger all kind of discussions. And the other statue that was going up, Boston B, that the liberal city that it was, especially at that time, and still is, I mean, by standard, you know, by standards of other cities, the statue to Crispus Attucks, you know, the first but man to die in the cause of American liberty in 1770. He is a black man. Well, he's half black and half Indian, a Natick Indian and African. So they're building these statues, and so all their conversations were talking about this. So Du Bois, as you all know, now we're coming to the end of this. Du Bois, who was from Western Massachusetts, right? Now, this is the New England preserve of the dreams. There was stuff going on all over the country. But it was so concentrated here, and there were so many dramatic things that happened, that's why I chose this particular place. And also because my own family was here, too. Yeah. So you know what he founded, right? You know what Du Bois founded. In 1905... tired of this segregation, which is going on, and tired of the fact that everybody that there's a big split in the black community. Most black people are being taught to accept segregation. And the leader in that is Booker T. Washington. And my writing on Booker T. Washington is very sympathetic to him, because in the South, it was either that teeny light or no light. And he chose to have, I don't like doing this, but, you know, and saying this, but if there are going to be kids that are going to be taught how to farm the land, how to be mechanics, how to be self-sufficient, this is the only way that we're going to be able to build the schools to do it and get the teachers to come from the North to teach it and do all these different things. So I'm going to say these words, which he hated to say, you know, but he paid that price. But, you know, he became vilified by the black community in the North. He was a hero in the South because all those kids had a place to go to school. Yeah, and there are other schools like in Georgia and other places who modeled on Booker T. So he founded his dream, and his dream was spreading to the South. Educate, become self-reliant. Then we'll take the next step. It was like Malcolm, you know. Educate, get yourself a J-O-B, know how you're going to do it, you know, something you can do. Get money, send your kids to college, let them learn the liberal arts and all like that. You get the money for them. That's your job. So he, you know, this split, you know, but people in the North saying, we want full rights right now. You know, Booker T, what are you talking about? You're spreading that gospel up here, you know. We don't want that. We want our rights now. That was what W.B. Du Bois was saying. So in 1905, he issues a call to 20 people, to 30 people, to come, actually there were 50 people, to come, including him, who he was his friend, remember, back in their student days, to come to Niagara Falls, and they're going to hammer out a program which has never been seen before. A militant protest organization dedicated to nothing but militant protest for equal rights now. It was called the Niagara Movement because they met in Niagara Falls. And it swept the nation. Negroes were just, yeah, that was the term that they called them in them, so I'm locked in this historical term. Yeah, that's what that was our name back then. But even back then, Afro-American was in a lot of the books, colored was in a lot of the books, you know, so forth and so on. So what happened was that they go there and they hammer out these principles, and it sweeps the North. It's on all the barbershops. There are these principles. They're in the book. They're printed out. And this is the first, you know about Martin Luther King and the protests and all like that. This is the protest of 1905. This is one of the oldest artifacts of the protests that they formed in 1905. You're going to go and we're going to protest in every town. You got to form a Niagara of chapters in every town, and you got to find out what's wrong in the town, and you got to protest it and demand it. So what Edwin did was to go back to New Bedford, and in 1905, on Thanksgiving night, he organized people, and who were they in New Bedford? They were the children of Frederick Douglass, you know, and they were the children of Sergeant Kearney, the guy who his daughter taught music. His daughter taught violin. That's what he did. And Frederick Douglass's children, you know, as you know, were in all kinds of politics and so forth. And so you can see here, and that's what I thought was interesting. You just want to pass it around, have people look. This is the movement that was just as electric as Black Lives Matter is to us now. And it not only swept the North, but what is very interesting and very little known is that it also swept the South. People think that people in the South gave up, you know, when the Klan took over and all like that from 1868 to 1890. It did not, the people did not give up, but they organized quietly and sometimes not so quietly, especially in places like Georgia, where Bishop Turner, who became one of the earliest bishops of the AME Church, who was a fierce fighter, fearless too, organized these conventions of protest. So they adopted the principles of Niagara there. And when the white press found out about it, they were vilified. The one thing that cannot happen is have this come down here. Well, in the North, wealthy white people, like William Lloyd Garrison's grandchildren, who became very wealthy, the Villards on the New York Central Stock, because they could get into business, but blacks could not be barred. So those heroes could go on and become wealthy. And whereas it caused some, you know, friction, how come we all played that price, but you get to do that? But they gave back. So they formed the NAACP and took Du Bois and the Niagara Movement and made it institutional. And they had enough money to keep it going. And that's what we, in this day and age, now black people have that kind of money, but we're not really doing that with our institutions as much as we should. We're really doing a lot more. Every year we're doing a lot more. But now we're starting to have the capital, and we have people that, like students who go and learn how to do all things. Are any around here? You know, we, the new generation, which is you, the new generation, you know, now have the tools. So we've got tools and we got capital. So that all started with this guy and W.B. Du Bois and Monroe Trotter. Remember Monroe Trotter? Boston guy. So now that brings us down. That is how the history in New England, of black protests, blacks having dreams, whites having dreams, everybody had, it sounds trite, but it is heavy duty, right? An American dream, because it all came out of that. We hold these truths to be self-evident, and people believed it. The fact is that people believed it. And as Paul Robeson said in Ballad for Americans, he says, and a gentleman believed it, and a little old lady believed it, and I believe it too. You know, and you know who I am. And the curly goes, who are you? He says, America. Remember that recording by Robeson? Oh, if you don't, go on Google and get it if you want to hear something powerful, you know. So there we are. We've come all the way up. And I'll close it the way I started it. It came up to what? The NAACP, right? What did it do? It formed the NAACP Legal Defense Fund. After World War II, it did voter registration, right? That started. And then you have the meetings with Martin Luther King about how can we make this happen. And he meets this great dean of divinity at Boston University, your university, right over there, and that's where that last transfer happened. And they all knew, they were all members of the NAACP, everybody was, even in the South, if you didn't admit it. I don't know, what does that stand for? You know. Do you know that, how many of you know, and this is my last story, so you have the King handoff right here, which is what I went over and gave my thanks to in the church before I talked. Because you have to do that. You have to respect. You have to have a spiritual connection with your past if you're going to have strength. And so the story of Rosa Parks is that she was a seamstress who just got tired and didn't want to move to the back of the bus. Rosa Parks was brought up and trained from childhood in the NAACP. She went to the Highland School, a school of where union people are trained how to do union protests. She was the secretary, the personal secretary of the state of Alabama
president of the NAACP, she was true blue, try hard, came out of the movement of this man and Du Bois and Monroe Trotter and a whole lot of other people, right? You see how it keeps getting passed on? So they said, but you know, I know how to do it. You know, I know I'm supposed to be this. And she played it to a T. You know, because without that sympathy, you know, she had come off as an arrogant civil rights NAACP, she'd have gotten no sympathy. So now we have come to this age, and I'll end it there, because that's where the New England contribution of the New England Dreamers fades off. There, you know, there hasn't been a... And I hope that as you're now in New England, some of you are from here, some of you from Texas and other places, I hope that you remember those simple things. You got to have a dream. There's no better dream than the dream that was invented in 1776. And that you got to persevere in that dream. And that the dream is total humanity, black, white. Men, women, Europeans, Chinese, South Americans, and so forth. It is the human dream. So keep on dreaming. Thanks.
This is Boston University's World of Ideas. You've just heard a lecture by author Spencer Jordan titled The Black and White Dream Dancers of the New England Past and Their Message for the Coming Generation. Tonight's lecture was presented by the Boston University African American Studies Program. Our moderator was African American Studies Program Director John Thornton. For a CD of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. That's 1-800-909-9287. You can also go to our website, wbur.org, to hear archived editions of this and all other WBUR programs. Tonight's program was produced by Mike Toda and Michael Garth with help from Mike Moschetto. Executive producer of Boston University's World of Ideas is Peter Lydotes. I'm Jack Lepiars. Thanks for joining us.